You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning. My name is George Perkovich. I'm a vice president for studies here at the Carnegie Endowment, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning. We have an outstanding panel, which we're delighted to present to you. The topic of the substantive discussion we're going to have is 1 year after Sunnylands, assessing the U.S.-China relationship. I'm going to ask a couple of questions of our panel, and then we'll open it up to a discussion. But in a preliminary way, I want to say that we are right now at the fourth anniversary of Carnegie's collaboration in Beijing with Tsinghua University. And we have just been delighted and extremely pleased by this collaboration. It made sense in a lot of ways. The two institutions are about the same age, which is older than all of us here in this room. It's pretty near 100 years. And obviously, the leading university in China, the oldest think tank on foreign policy in the U.S. But I'd have to say that the collaboration has kind of exceeded even our expectations from 4 years ago. And one of the reasons is Dr. Zhang and the role that that he has played, and our colleagues. So we have two of our colleagues from Tsinghua here today, and the director of the center, Paul Henley. And so I thought it might be useful for each to say a couple of words about the collaboration and the value as each of you see it, and then we'll turn to the issue of post-Sunnylands and U.S.-China relations.
Okay. Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for coming for this joint program. And actually, our Tsinghua University and Carnegie endorsement and set up this joint center. And we have make a big progress and in Beijing. And the very first year, we have the seminar, and it was reported in the People's Daily. You know that? And it's not easy to be reported by People's Daily. And when you have some international discussions, and certainly it's easy to get on website and the internet, but not People's Daily. So we think that's very positive. And in the last 3 years, and we have organized almost 100 panels, discussions, and it's quite it's gaining a momentum. And I think this is the first time for our two institutions to have a joint program at Carnegie. So we hope today we can have this discussion as successful as what we did in Beijing. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dr. Paul. Well, first, I just want to welcome everyone for coming today, and especially welcome our Chinese guests, Dr. Yan Shui Tong and Dr. Sun Shui Feng, who are our partners, as George mentioned, in Beijing. And we are have just completed our fourth year as partners. And frankly, I personally have been surprised to the extent that we have been able to make progress. And I came to the Carnegie Endowment after serving 5 years in the National Security Council as China director under both President Bush and President Obama. And one of the things that was very clear to me during my time in government was that the number of issues where we were working, where we needed to find ways to cooperate with China, grew and grew over that time period. And I remember writing memos for the president, start out maybe this long, but after several years, you know, they're this long because the person in the NSC who works on climate change wants something in the memo. The person who's working on Iran wants something in the memo. The list of areas where we have the possibility to cooperate with China is a long list. And I think I saw this effort as a way to figure out how the U.S. and China could really begin to try to realize that cooperation. I don't think we have done it to the extent that is possible yet, but I think that our platform that we created in Beijing is working towards that goal. And I often say that if at the macro level, the U.S. and Chinese governments could accomplish what we've accomplished at the micro level, then I think we would be in a better position today. We've actually figured out, we don't always agree on the substantive issues, as you'll see probably today when we talk about U.S.-China relations, but we have figured out a way to achieve our common objectives in a way that works for our Tsinghua partners and in a way that works for our Carnegie partners. And I think that sort of model of cooperation, actually, a lot could be learned from it, and it has taken a lot of relationship building, getting to know each other, getting to understand each other's views and positions, not sugarcoating things or pulling punches, but being very honest, but in a respectful way, and in an effort, really, to try to find constructive solutions to today's common global challenges where China has a stake, the U.S. has a stake, and the international community has a stake. So I want to thank our Tsinghua partners for coming today and for the partnership that we've managed to achieve over the last 4 years.
Great. Thanks, Paul. We're going to turn now to the policy issues, but before doing that, and you have the bios of each of the four panelists, but I want to just continue down the line just to introduce Yukon Wong, who's here in Washington with us, but provides invaluable perspective, especially on the Chinese economy, where he was the director of the World Bank's office in Beijing, the country director for the bank in China, and then with the same job in Russia and the former Soviet Central Asian republics, and writes very trenchantly and provocatively on the Chinese economy. For those of you who follow them, you'll appreciate that, and those of you who don't can begin to follow them. And then Dr. Sun Shifeng, who's from Tsinghua Center as well, and doing a lot of work on kind of perceptions of China's rise, both in the region and globally. And so that will be some of the topic that we'll be discussing as we go through this morning. Let me just start with a broad question, and ask Dr. Yang, the 35 years since normalization of relations, 1 year since the Sunnyland Summit, which, as people remember, was informal and it was to be signaling a new relationship. After that year, how would you describe the dynamic now in both the interest in impelling cooperation, but also there's a fair sense of competition still out there and rivalry? And describe for us the drivers of the relationship as you see them now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this now we move into a new stage, and we started to work together to establish a new type of a relationship between China and the U.S. And both sides, from my understanding, still are lack of experience how to make that happen, what kind of a relationship and we can really have. And although this idea initiated from the Chinese aspects, and at the beginning, American government, Obama administration has thought about it, have some suspicion about it. But then, from understanding last year, and this idea moving forward. So we remember that by the end of last year, and Susan Rice and deliver a speech and at the Georgetown University, and with this term, a new model of the major powers. But then after that, and from understanding the relationship still, this kind of efforts still make ahead. But then in the last 2 months, it seemed to me it becomes bumpy. That means we are going to have new problems between China and the U.S. And I think it's very normal. And because each side and still do not have experience and about this a new relationship between the rising power and the status power, we want to have this kind of relationship different from what we know in the history. That means we want to create something we never know. So this is really a new thing. So that's why it's difficult. And from understanding, the most positive part is that the leaders of both sides and quite positive on this idea. And generally speaking, from understanding, they agree with each other. They concern they regard it as very necessary for prevent a confrontation between China and the U.S. And from my understanding, it seems to me, and there's more problems at the working bureaucratic level rather than at the political leadership level. That's so I think in the next the coming months, possibly, and we're going to have a SED in July, right? And so I think that meeting will provide a new opportunity for both sides to sit together to discuss about how can we substantialize this relationship. Okay.
Do you guys want to add anything on that broader question of if you're looking at the out over the next couple of years on the relationship, and notwithstanding the desire to have a new model relationship, new could be good, new could be bad, new could be peaceful, new could be bumpy. So how do you guys look at that too? Dr. Sun, sure.
Well, George, I'm glad you started out by asking to look at the relationship over a 35-year period, because I think, you know, as you look at the newspapers, you could easily come to the conclusion that the relationship is spiraling out of control and is in a rapid deterioration, and we are moving towards inevitable conflict or confrontation. We certainly have problems. We've always had problems in the U.S.-China relationship. We have things on the positive side, things on the negative side. But if you look at the 35-year context of this relationship, which started out normalizing in 1979 after a 30-year period of virtually no relationship whatsoever. You have to remember when Kissinger took his secret trip to China, he couldn't communicate with Chinese officials. He had to go through Pakistan officials to communicate with China. So if you look at it from that context, I think the trajectory of our relationship has been on an upward curve. Now, if you look at it in a short-term context where we are today, 1 year out from Sunnylands, I think we have a number of problems that we need to address, serious problems, whether it's cyber or maritime issues or mill-to-mill relations. There are a number of issues that we can talk about today which we need to find ways to manage. But I think the concern that I have today is 1 year out from Sunnylands, I saw that as a good starting point. And I had hoped to see more meetings between our two presidents in an informal, no-necktie kind of format where the two leaders could get to know each other. We don't have a sort of Sunnylands 2 scheduled. We've had only a few meetings between our two presidents, and they've taken place on the margins of larger events. And you can't get a lot of work done, and you can't build a relationship that way. I also think that the problem we have today in the relationship is that the problems we have in the relationship are beginning to define the relationship. And there is not enough good to talk about. And I think we, our leaders at the highest levels in China and the United States, need to begin to address that and begin to figure out in this, if we are going to move towards this new type of great power relations concept that China put forward, how is it that our two countries are going to enhance cooperation on areas where we both have common stakes? We haven't really done that yet. And I think it'll take a lot of energy and a lot of thinking on both sides. And I think it will take ideas from the Chinese side as to where we can cooperate. We're very good in the United States government of coming to the Chinese with long lists of where we can cooperate. And we think about this by examining our own interests and examining also at the same where we think China's interests are. And we do our own calculation of where they coincide, and we go to the Chinese and say, here's where we think we can cooperate. But I fear that our Chinese partners have taken that as, here's where the U.S. needs help from China as a sub-partner in the process in an area where it will really only help the United States and not China. And I think the only way around that obstacle is for Chinese leadership to begin to put more ideas forward on the table for consideration on where we can cooperate. And Vice Foreign Minister Wang Yi at the press conference at the National People's Congress in March said that China will begin to play a larger role internationally and will do so by putting Chinese ideas on how global crises and international issues can be solved. And I think that will help us as we begin to think through how we can work better together. And then that, I think, can provide a better context for the relationship that will allow us to work on those areas where we have disagreements.
Yukon, do you, when you think about the economies of both countries and then the economic relationship between both countries. Do you see that as more conducive to cooperation or to conflict?
I mean, the hope of it is that if you focus on economic issues, that you'll get into a set of concerns which will be mutually beneficial to both sides. And therefore, it will lower what I would call the security and political tensions. But this is not going to be easy. It's difficult. Here you have the largest, two largest economies, two largest trading nations. If I had to describe their economic relationships, I would describe it as underdeveloped, unbalanced, and politically fragile. And this is going to be very difficult to work with. You have two major geoeconomic initiatives out there. For the U.S., it's the pivot or the rebalancing. But from the China side, it's seeing its containment. From the China side, the major geographical focus is actually not to look east, but to look west. So you have the revival of the Silk Route, the land route through Central Asia to Europe, the revival through the maritime route through Singapore, South Asia, to the Middle East. That's hopes to find a more productive interaction. But that's not particularly good because there's no productive interaction between U.S. and China in that context. Then you have what I would call the four acronyms. Two trade relationships, the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, and RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. Now, the problem with these two trade relationships is that they exclude each other. China is not in one, the U.S. is not in the other. That doesn't make sense. Now, you have two other acronyms which I think have potential. You have the BIT, the Bilateral Investment Treaty. There's great potential, but very, very difficult. Issues like cybersecurity, SOEs, will dominate the agenda. It's hard to see how the world's major technological superpower, the United States, can forge an understanding with a country whose per capita GDP is number 99, and its institutions reflect that standing. How can they reach an agreement on this? Now, very recently, the fourth acronym came up, and this is the, I have to remember this one, the FTAAP, Free Trade Agreement for Asia-Pacific. Under APEC auspices. It has the potential of bringing both the United States and China into a discussion, but it's not received very much warm support by other partners. So I think this is a real difficult issue. Can you find agreements which actually bring both sides into what I call a more harmonious discussion rather than draw them into more sensitive issues?
Thank you, Dr. Sun, when you think about this question from, and especially from your studies of kind of regional reactions to China's rise, how do you think about the future going forward of cooperation versus conflict?
Okay, my point will be very simple. I fully agree with Professor Yan and Dr. Paul. That is, okay, that China and the United States, the bilateral relations has so many problems and so many competitions. But what I want to argue that is what is the most important problem or the issues between the two countries and China and the United States. In terms of the regional security or in terms of the security issues, I argue that is the most important problem. It's not the bilateral issues. It's that's how China and the United States and its alliance network can manage its the relations or all relations. That is how China manages relations with the United States and the Japan alliance, and how China manages relations with the United States and the Philippine alliance. I think that's the most important, very, very important problem. Why? Because we do not have enough knowledge, IR knowledge, to understand this kind of phenomena. We have enough knowledge to understand, okay, the great power competition between UK and Germany, and between maybe France and UK. And we also have enough knowledge about that two groups, two blocks, Soviet Union and the United States, and Warsaw Pact Treaty Organization and NATO. But we do not have enough knowledge to understand the current problem between China and the United States. That, okay, United States established alliance network in East Asia, but China is a lonely rising power. Just like Paul in Beijing, yes? Paul is a lonely rising power. And Paul had to face the faculty members in the department. Yes, I think that's the key problem for the new major power relations between China and the United States.
I'm glad you raised that, and I want to come back to it, because as somebody who works a lot on nuclear issues and the issue of extended deterrence, which is in part what you're talking about with alliance relations, it's an extremely hard dynamic, and actually for which there's relatively little theory. Even if the theory were good, there's relatively little of it. So it really is a key challenge. Rather than my asking more questions, my guess is that everybody here would have thought of the questions I would ask and would frame them better. So I want to open it up to a discussion, and I assume we're going to get into some of the issues that each of the panelists have raised, including the cyber and the territorial questions, but anything. So raise your hand, and then when I call on you, one of our colleagues will bring a microphone, and then please identify yourself. Even those of you who, like Ambassador Solomon, don't need introductions, you should go ahead and still do that. Okay? So we'll start over there, and then here, and then we'll come back this way. Yeah.
Alexander Panov, RTVI, American-Russian TV. Facing U.S. sanctions, Russia is going to the east, going to China. How could you comment the tremendous contract, gas contract with China? And actually, what do you feel could be a Russia rising partner for a lonely rising power, China?
And if you know what the price was, please tell us. Anybody want to comment on that? Okay.
Okay. Well, actually, no one knows about at this moment. I don't think even the negotiators knows what the final price will be. And one thing is clear, and the contract signed between China and the U.S. will between Russia release the pressure on the Russia and facing the potential sanction imposed by the West. And strategically, and I think this treaty and lay a new political condition for China and Russia to strengthen their strategic cooperation. And so from my understanding, this contract is more political rather than economic. And second thing is about the whether Russia is a rising power or not. For me, I don't think Russia is a rising power. I think at this moment, Russia is still declining power. And in my latest book, published last year, I argued that, and in the history, you never have a superpower or empire resumed their traditional position, and within 10 years after they start to decline. So all the history, all of the historical cases shows that, and a major power, when they decline, the yearly, the continuity, the initial of the history, I call it, and it will continue for a century. And so I don't think Russia have the chance to resume superpower positions within my life. I think it is quite difficult. And the reason is that even for the case in the Ukraine, and both the Western media and Chinese media, although they do not agree with each other in terms of political positions, but then they share the same view of analysis. They all regard the Russian and gaining the upper hand on this issue, and Putin smart enough and to expanding Russian's influence. For me, I think the media analysis is wrong. And if you look at the situation, the Ukraine used to be the Russians' allies. Now, even today, even the Russian, even the Ukraine finally was split into two countries, and West and the East, and at least the West part will join the Europe. So, generally speaking, if you look at this issue from historical perspective, then you find that the Russians' influence is a shrinking rather than expanding.
I would just add one thing. I agree there's a political element to the decision. I also frankly think there's an economic and commercial element. And you know, the Chinese are very good at negotiating. And I'm sure they saw Russia in a very weakened position, desperate for a deal. Now the details of the arrangement were quite opaque. So as George said, we don't really know what the price was. I understand it's roughly equivalent, perhaps, to what the EU is paying, but I also understand there's a lot of sweeteners thrown into the deal. And so I think the Chinese saw an opportunity to finally conclude a deal that was advantageous on their part. And I think also China sees it in its benefit to let the United States and the West know it has strategic options if things don't go well in its relationship with the West. So I think there's both probably economic aspects and political aspects mixed together is my own sense.
Yes, right here.
Mike Mosetic, PBS Online NewsHour. There's an interesting colloquy developing here in the United States in places like the Nelson Report, which I think a lot of you are familiar with. But so far, it's only been with Americans. And since we have two very well-informed Chinese scholars here, I'd like to get their take. And it's basically over the question of what is the ultimate Chinese aim vis-a-vis the United States? Is it to share power in the Pacific, Asia Pacific, or is it to displace American power? And the fact that I use two different terms expresses some of the part of the debate. The United States tends to talk about Asia Pacific. China tends to talk more about Asia.
Uh-huh. I know Dr. Yan has no views on this topic. Go ahead.
Please. I do it, yeah, and then, not and then, others?
No, go ahead, and you start, and then...
Okay, I try to be very brief, okay? And actually, when we're talking about the final goals, it's harder to define. And for me, including my last book, I usually talk of things within 10 years. And no matter what the motivation of our government has, the question is that what capability we can do within 10 years. So within the next 10 years, I don't think we have any a capability to replace the U.S. in this region, and including East Asia. Second, the term of Asia is very, very very murky. And when we're talking about Asia, it could be the geographical area from Israel to Japan, and also could be only China, Japan, and South Korea, and the first three countries. So this concept is very confusing. And I think your question actually is targeted at the very recent meeting held in Beijing, and they're talking about the Asians should be responsible for the Asian security, right? You know, I think that's what you're talking about. And from my understanding, people ignore one thing, and it's the principle, and also stated by the Xi Jinping, that our policy is open. The security cooperation is open. It's not regional bounded. And so from my understanding, the concept, the Asian security concept, is talking about the mentality. It's not talking about the policy. The Asian security concept actually refers to we have a different view from the traditional so-called the Cold War mentality or the European-centric mentality, something like that. I think that is talking about the mentality rather than the policy.
And that goes to something Dr. Sun referred to about alliances, in the sense that some of the Asian states have alliances that bring in other powers. So they're Asian states, but they made choices to relate to outside powers. It's complicated. Do you want to add anything to that? You don't have to, but if you want to add anything to this question.
Okay, I just want to add a few words to Professor Yan's response. Okay, in Asia, the concept Asia is so vague. Yes, it's hard to define. And Asia Pacific, that's the term coined by the United States. I think that is more meaningful for Chinese scholars and for Chinese. That is, we always talk about the surrounded areas. Surrounded area can maybe divided into three parts. That's East Asia or Southeast Asia. Now we together call the East Asia and then Central Asia and then South Asia. So I think that's we need to understand, okay, how China understands its surrounded areas rather than just Asia or Asia Pacific. We always can observe our the regional context as three surrounded areas. That's East Asia, dominated by United States, East Central Asia, dominated by Russia, and South Asia, that's the balance of power maybe between India and Pakistan.
The lady in the back there.
Thank you. My question is about the cyber.
Please tell, introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. I'm Boyali with People's Daily. My question is about, do you think this, the nature of cyber war actually requires a new way of thinking in terms of cooperation between United States and China? And do you think the way of trust by verify can be a way forward? And how could trust be built between the two nations in terms of cyber cooperation? Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Good question. Anybody on cyber?
You want me to say? Well, I think this is obviously this is a major issue that the United States and China need to come to terms with. And you know, we've seen the United States over the last couple of years gradually build up its concern on one specific aspect, and that is cyber theft. It's had a difficult time making its case, both to the Chinese and internationally, because of Snowden. However, I think it's important, you know, to point out that to date, what Snowden is talking about is cyber espionage. And I think this is something, as all of you know in this room, that all countries do. The United States does it. In fact, you know, I was a diplomat in China, and I'm well aware that the Chinese have very good capabilities in this regard. We do not, however, have the Chinese Snowden that has stepped forward yet, but if we ever do, I'm sure we're going to learn about how good the Chinese espionage capabilities are. But the administration is trying to make a different point, and that is a very specific point about cyber theft of intellectual property from U.S. companies. And it's having a very difficult time doing that, and I think you can see last week the indictment of five PLA officers from this unit in Shanghai, that this hacking unit was its latest attempt to be heard. And I think the United States, you know, knew that China would come back with its own measures to counter the indictments. And I think that should give you a sense of the level of frustration on the U.S. government. It knew that the Chinese government would do something to retaliate, but yet it made the indictments nevertheless. And I think it is symbolic, but it is also an effort by the U.S. administration to say, we really want to talk about this issue. It's affecting American businesses. You're talking estimates between $50 billion and $200 billion in losses of U.S. companies. And there's a lot of pressure on the U.S. government by U.S. businesses to bring this issue forward. And I guess one of my biggest concerns in this regard is the U.S. business community in the across the spectrum of the U.S.-China relationship has always been a very constructive voice. And when times have been tough between the U.S. and China, it's the business community that has stepped forward and said, we need to think about the long-term nature of our relationship and how can we get this back in a better place. But I worry that the U.S. business community is actually becoming very frustrated with what's happening to its own businesses in China. And so I think this particular issue, I think, is one that the administration would like to put on the table and try to find a way to resolve.
But doesn't that cut multiple ways? I mean, in other words, the business community is also frustrated that the NSA and others use flaws in American business software to then penetrate other countries without getting the permission of those companies, and then that may close off markets because potential customers are saying, wait, we don't want to be buying products that are allowing you to exploit and penetrate into our country. So the business arguments work both ways, and I mean, this leads to another question, as does what you very rightly said. You know, the U.S. argument, which is espionage is what countries do, you know, get used to it, we all do it, but stealing from private companies is wrong, whereas we'll steal from state-owned companies in the same sector, but it's, well, they're state-owned, and therefore it's okay. It's not a private company.
Well, I'm not sure we've stolen. I mean, we may have stolen from state-owned enterprises, but I don't know. Huawei, as I know, was an effort to go in to figure out what the ties were to the PLA, and I think that was also part of an effort to figure out how to deal with Huawei in the United States. But I don't think that the United States government has gone in and stolen IPR from Huawei and given it to Cisco and given it to IBM. I may be wrong, but I don't think so.
I think what the U.S. government said, or what David Sanger anyway has reported, is it's not that so much then it's given to private companies, but that knowledge is then used in trade negotiations for the benefit of a sector, if not for a private company. I guess where I'm going, though, is with the question, because I think it's super important. One, does anybody think the potential for agreeing on rules, which was implied in the idea of trust but verify, some code of conduct or rules, that potential could be reached without everybody willing to put their stuff on the table? In other words, we can't say, well, what's mine is mine, what's yours, let's negotiate over. You're going to have to talk about some parity. But also that it can't be done just with the U.S. and China. In other words, it would have to be a broader discussion, a broader effort. Are those two premises wrong? Is there some other way to do this?
Well, first, I think you're right. I agree with you that this distinction the United States is trying to make is going to be a very hard case for the Chinese, for the United States to do, as because of the gray areas that you point out and other areas. Nevertheless, you know, U.S. businesses do feel their IPR is stolen, and it's an issue, and so the U.S. government, I think, wants to put it on the table. The harder issue, obviously, as you point out, is what kind of framework do we put together between the United States and China, or broader, that can work to alleviate these concerns. The distinction the United States is trying to make, let's be clear, is not one that is recognized in China, and I think also throughout the international community. So the United States has a very difficult challenge ahead of it. But nevertheless, I think it felt it has to do something. And I also worry that if we're not able to resolve this to some degree, to the U.S. business community satisfaction, you will see this gradual buildup continue. And ultimately, we will have a situation potentially where you have offensive operations going back and forth between the China and the United States, and I think this is not in either of our interests or the interests of the international community.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a very good question, and the reason is that this cybersecurity is not the bilateral issue. It's a global issue. And now the internet is something like the electricity and the running water, and all the human beings live on that. And so from the security for the cyber is a very serious issue, not for the government, for the ordinary people. So whenever we need norms to govern this kind of global issues, and we definitely need the multilateral regulation, not bilateral. But before we have the multilateral agreements, we need to start it from the major powers. And at this moment, and I doubt any country can be so boldly to claim they have a more cyber espionage capability than the United States. And I, like Paul said, China is very capable. I hope we are more capable than the U.S., but I doubt American computer engineers agree with that. Mm-hmm. And so from my understanding, the U.S. need to take the lead to do something. And if possible, China and the U.S. can work together to work out something, or at least a draft for the world, that would be positive. And so from my understanding, we need some, generally speaking, if you look at all these international norms, most of them started from the negotiation between the major powers. And after they developed some agreements, and then they practiced by the a few major powers and followed by the majority countries, and then it becomes the international norm. So I think the process requires U.S. and gave a serious consideration about the negotiation with China on the cybersecurity security issues.
And how would the, I mean, just procedurally, how can you imagine a bilateral discussion on that taking off? I know there have been attemps, but at what level would that have to be?
There's a working group. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, due to the current the U.S. initiative and to sue the Chinese five PLA soldiers, and then this working group stopped. Actually, according to my understanding, this working group cannot achieve something. And because of the several reasons. And first the reason is that it's too short. It's just worked for a few months. And then they have no chance to continue. The second And it seems to me both sides didn't start from the easy issue. For instance, and in most cases, they heavily focus on the government interests rather than focus on the civilians' interests. Mm. And actually, from my understanding, if they started talking about the cooperation or the regulations on the civilian issues, they will be much easier than talking about the government's secrets.
Any, I don't want to overdo it, but any questions on this issue, on cyber, anybody on that question? And don't lie. So, okay, so you're going to be the test case. If you lie, that's it.
Well, you be the judge. No, I want to, David Lynch with Bloomberg. I want to go back to something Paul said about the retaliation that the Chinese government's pursuing in response to the indictments from last week. One element of that has been an effort to accelerate a move by Chinese state-owned banks and perhaps other enterprises to move away from doing business with U.S. technology companies and consultants and possibly others. And I'd be interested in everyone's assessment of how real and extensive this is likely to be. Is it just for show? Will the banks perhaps study the option of moving away from IBM but not ultimately do it? Or is this presaging a broader move away from U.S. companies?
Thank you. You kept your word. You're a man of honor. Anybody want to
try? Sure, I'll just very briefly. I think this is not new, frankly. If you talk to IBM, you know, their profits have been dwindling in China for quite a long time. And so I think it is one, it is symbolic, it is retaliatory to say we have options and we're going to strike back. And I think that there is a desire on their end to use their own national companies to do the work that IBM and Cisco and others have been doing. I think realistically it will take a long time because, you know, government agencies, state-owned enterprises, companies are all using IBM software and other companies, American companies, technology. So this will take a long time to do, but I think it checks a lot of boxes on the agenda of China. It supports their national companies. It is symbolic in terms of retaliating, and I think and now this latest with Boston Consulting Group and McKinsey. This is a new one, and I don't know how that will play out, but they have announced that state-owned enterprises should not do work with Boston Consulting Group, McKinsey's, others of this sort. I have not heard whether or not that has actually sort of taken shape and how it's unfolding. But that's a new one. But the IBM and Cisco and the others, I think they have seen an impact on their business over the last several years. This is not new.
Yes, sir, and then Dick. No.
Hi, Chen Weihua, China Daily. Question, because we're talking about Sunnyland, so would you give a general overall assessment, like a year later, are we moving a step forward or step backward towards our vision? Seems all the trouble in the way we are just adding more obstacle, to the goal. Talk about indictment. And to me, watching, say, TV channels on both sides, I think the Chinese Americans, panelists, people like you, are definitely talking, bypassing each other, you know. Chinese is still talking about U.S. containment in every of U.S. You are based in Beijing, certainly aware of that. Here, every step China make is considered a threat. China is the, you know, the troublemaker, you know, they're going to rock the boat, you know. So are we, you know, going to, even on the cyber thing, is this indictment actually a smart move, towards solving issues, or to, in your words, make your U.S. voice heard? Thank you.
Okay. Actually, from my understanding, and I think this situation in the last 3 months is a little bit a step back. And the momentum stopped. And from my understanding, that's mainly and come from these both sides are not very satisfied with these achievements. And from my understanding, and the reason, that's my analysis, because both sides defined this kind of relationship is based on the is mainly for cooperation, and regarded the cooperation as the goal. And from my understanding, if both sides change their understanding or about this relationship, and the cooperation regarded as a method, approach, and the way or the means to achieve a new goal, the goal is that prevent confrontation, prevent the conflicts escalating into confrontation, then the situation will be changed. Because both sides are talking about cooperation so much, and when they cannot develop cooperation, so you know that people blame that well, because of lack of mutual trust. When you're talking about mutual trust, the base as the cooperation between the two countries, and then as soon as you cannot have develop a new cooperation, and you say, hey, he's not my friend. We cannot trust him because we never trust each other. So if we think the things in the other way and ignore the concept of trust, why we cannot develop cooperation without trust? We do not need the trust. And we see that the Soviet Union and the UK and US cooperated during the World War II without any mutual trust. And when Mao Zedong shake hands with Nixon, there's no any trust. And when the Nixon with China and have dinner with Jiang Zemin, there's no any trust. So the fact is that if we change our view about how to establish the new relationship between our two countries, and then we find that there's a different approaches to that goal. And so from my understanding, nowadays too much a problem with that because there's too high expectation for cooperation. They didn't regard cooperation as approach or the means. And so when they cannot achieve that cooperation, they say, hey, you're lying to me. You promised to cooperate with me, but you didn't cooperate with me on this issue. And so when both sides blame each other and are not satisfied with the other's response, and then we have the setback. So that's my understanding. We need to, both sides need to have a common definition of the new security call, new relationship.
And premised on the realism of distrust to begin with, and nonetheless how to solve problems if there's distrust.
I think the precondition is that we should be very frank with each other to admit that there's no trust between us.
Right.
And so the question is that how can we develop cooperation without trust?
Right.
Let's forget the trust.
Right.
If we have trust, fine. Without trust, we can still survive. So without trust, we still can cooperate. And without trust, maybe we cooperate better than that.
That's a perfect... I think he's absolutely right. That's a perfect segue to a distinguished ambassador, Richard Solomon. Your question.
Dick Solomon from RAND. I see a fundamental Maldoon, a contradiction in China's approach to the world. On the one hand, the peaceful rise theme, the need to focus on economic development. China's fundamental security problem is internal stability with the millions of people whose standards of living have been raised and the concern that economic problems will put these people out of work. So one major theme, and maybe the dominant one, is to maintain stability and good economic relations. But that perspective is really in contradiction with what we've seen more recently in China's aggressive approach on these territorial disputes, its posture on cyber and other issues, which are creating this real tension. And I think the point was made by Mr. Henley that the problems are now beginning to define the character of the relationship. Now, how do you resolve this Maldoon, this contradiction? That is, in many ways, the big problem. Now, China talks about a new pattern of major power relations. And there are various ways of describing it, but I think the underlying conception in China's mind is we have our way of managing our relations. You have your way of managing your and our affairs. You do it your way, and maybe, as was just said, we can collaborate in some areas even though we distrust each other. For example, the Chinese Communist Party is very concerned about the degree to which the United States pushes forward on values issues, human rights, and all the other issues. It has this internal directive about the Chigabu, the seven no areas. So that's a fundamental issue for China of stability. And how do you resolve this tension? China talks about a multipolar world. And the question really where their military is developing the ability to counter or push us out of their front yard, can you really resolve this contradiction on the basis with the elements we've described?
My response, very brief. Oh, okay. I think in China, a lot of people argue in this way. And they think that they find that there's a contradiction between China's rhetorical service or propaganda and the real action and in the last 2 years. And actually, the peaceful rise has been carried out for a long time. And the new model of the major power relationship started from the last 2 years. And then let's ignore the sunny lands and the issue. Before that, when China's behavior is not so assertive, like the Western media said, do we have good relationship? Do our relationship stabilized? And can U.S. do not feel China is a threat? The China threat started from 1993. And before people talking anything so assertive, still the media in this country feel China is a threat. So for my understanding, no matter what we do, and because China is not a member of the Western club, so you're always a threat, no matter what you do. And the second thing is that look at the history. I like Paul's analysis from the historical perspective. If you look at the history from the end of the Cold War, and we have the EP3 accident, we have the bombing of the Chinese embassy, even this happened, China is still regarded as a threat. And why? And China is the only country have never involved in any war since 1984. And even the Japan sent troops to the war in the Iraq. And China is the only major power didn't involve in the war in the world. And for 25 years. And then what? China still is more threatening than the other, all of the major powers who fight wars. So from my understanding, it's not what China behave. It's whether China join this club or not.
We would have welcomed China in the Gulf War, but
I doubt.
Can I just add one
thing? Yeah, please, and I'm going to translate.
I just want, Mr. Solomon, I agree very much with what you said. I think this is this contradiction, and you see it in a number of places. I would add the new type of great power relationship. What is one of the things desired on the Chinese side that I hear from my Chinese friends is that China wants more respect on the international stage, that it has risen and it wants more respect. But I think the question is, what kind of power is China going to be? And that question is unanswered for outside observers, but it's also, I think, unanswered within China. I think Yan Shuitong alluded to that. And I think this creates all sorts of anxiety. If you look at the Asia-Pacific, for example, you see a very contradictory approach. Xi Jinping went to Central Asia in the fall of last year in an effort to improve relations and to convince countries in Central Asia that China's rise will benefit those countries. Talked about billions of dollars worth of trade deals. Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang then went to Southeast Asia, in the backdrop of President Obama not being able to go, and did a very good job of moving along a charm offensive to try to convince countries that its rise will benefit them as well. But then I think largely there is, I think, you know, a sense that China that it's been held down for 100 or more years and it's been a victim to abuse by outside powers. And so it also feels a need to stand up to countries in the region. And you see this on the maritime territorial issues. And this, China's, I would say, behavior in this regard is creating real anxiety and uncertainty. And it's undercutting its other approach at trying to charm the countries in the region that China, and convince these countries that its rise will benefit them. So I think countries are left with a question of what kind of power are we going to see China become? And that's where I think you see hedging strategies come in, which then lead Chinese observers to believe that the United States is trying to contain it, when I think the United States actually has a policy of engagement. If we were trying to contain China, if that was our strategy, then one could conclude that we have been failing miserably, because China certainly has not been contained. China is a great economic power. The question is, what will it do to contribute, I think, to the international community, the public goods, in a way that is constructive and contributes? It complains that it doesn't like Western domination of multilateral and international organizations, but it needs to explain how it wants that to be modified or adjusted, and that I have not heard yet. It complains about Western approaches to solving crises in Syria and Afghanistan and other places, but I don't think yet it has been in a position to put forward its own constructive solutions, and I think it needs to begin to do that if it wants to gain the respect that it wants through this new type of great power relationship concept.
Oh, thank you. My name is Zhang Hong. I'm from Caixin Media of China. So I'm very glad that you actually are leading to my question, because I want to ask a question about South Asia and Central Asia, because I think too much discussion has been focused on East Asia in the discussion about Sino-US relationship. So when we look at South Asia, and especially when President Obama yesterday announced the steps to withdraw from Afghanistan, so my first question is, does China have a strategy on Afghanistan? Because China has become a major investor in this country. And in the past, there has been much complaint about China being a free rider of U.S. Provision of security in this region. So does China have a strategy now U.S. are going to withdraw from Afghanistan? And also, I want to ask, is counterterrorism, can counterterrorism become a new driver of the bilateral relationship between China and U.S. in South Asia and perhaps in also Central Asia? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody on those questions? Afghanistan, China have a strategy in Afghanistan and in counterterrorism?
Okay. I think the U.S. have talked with China for years. For whether possible for China to undertake over the responsibility for the security situation in Afghanistan. And the question is that if US and NATO are not able to implement that duty, how can China to implement duty by itself? And I don't think we have that kind of a military capability stronger than the whole NATO, right? So first is the capability. The second thing is that we have to ask the question. And why the U.S. strategy in this country cannot achieve the goal? So that means if we follow Americans' strategy continue, we still cannot stabilize that country. And America failed in Afghanistan, NATO failed in Afghanistan. If we repeat that, that just means we repeat the failure. It's meaningless to repeat the failure. The last point is that China definitely gave a great concern about this situation. We do a serious study about what will happen to Afghanistan after U.S. withdrawal from this region. The situation will become the better in this country or getting even worse. And from my standing, everyone, the general judgment that the situation will getting worse. For us, we understand the worst is the question is not whether the situation is getting worse in that country, is that what the impact of the worsened situation will be on China. You all know that a terrorist problem become worse and worse in Xinjiang province, and so the linkage becomes a big issue. So from my understanding, Chinese government has prepared and to deal with this issue, but I don't think that issue is a part of Americans' general plan to get troops withdrawn from the U.S., and certainly not that simple, and the U.S. get troops out of there and then PLA get in. Definitely not. So from my understanding, China will have used its own way to deal with Afghanistan, but that will be very different from U.S. strategy and the U.S. military operation.
Yes, Sarah here, and then we'll come over here.
Hi, Hank Levine with the Albright-Stonebridge Group. Paul referred to the fact that the U.S. business community, particularly the big multinationals, have long been sort of a stabilizing factor in the relationship, and I'd share the assessment that over the last 5 or 6 years, while they continue to play that role, maybe their enthusiasm has declined a little bit as they become more concerned about some developments in China. Cyber is, I think, indeed a part of that, but more broadly is the question of economic reform and opening in China, and the sense that the Chinese government over the last 6 or 8 years has interfered more through industrial policies. And I guess the question I would ask, and maybe Yukon first or others, there's some sense, I think, growing among the business community that although the vision of the third plenum on economic reform was very was broad and impressive, that the implementation is going slowly. And in fact, that maybe the economic reformers are feeling that they're facing more opposition than they felt. This will be a key element, in my view, in U.S.-China relations going forward because of the important role that U.S. companies play in the relationship. So I guess I'd be interested in an assessment of economic reform, how things are going so far, and how we think things will go.
Good question. Yukon, you want
to? Just some general comments. China is proceeding very rapidly on liberalizing the financial system, opening up its capital flows in the markets. This will not make China a more secure country. It actually will become less secure because it's going to be subject to the vagaries of the global economies, the forces, exchange rates of capital move in and out. It has less control of the economy. So do not think that reform actually will make China more confident in tackling either political or other issues. It's going to be more vulnerable in many aspects. The second point I would basically add is China's entering in what I call very delicate stages of development process. It's an upper middle income country. It needs to go to high income status. For that to occur, it has to be through innovation and technology upgrading rather than low cost exporting your investments. So the conflict between America with the highest technology and the best standards and aspiring upper middle income country, which needs to go up the innovation ladder, is going to be more tense rather than less tense. That's why American companies feel this kind of pressure. China does not need American money. China's got too much money. China basically wants stronger institutions and technology. And does they get it by buying it, copying it, or stealing it? This is the reason why you have this kind of tension. So we should not predict or think that this particular kind of relationship is going to get easier. It's going to get harder. If you look throughout East Asia, the only countries that have gone from upper middle income to high, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, and ultimately, they did it through what I would call indigenous innovation. They didn't do it through FDI or multinational roles. That's what characterizes this few countries. So China's sitting there watching, what should I do? And frankly, they're a bit stuck because they're running against these international standards, the concerns of the political agenda and the international relationships, but also asks the question, how do I get to the next bound? So my argument to you is, reform is going to actually not make it easier. It's going to actually create more stresses. This is going to be a very difficult period.
Anybody else on that? Okay, Arnold, then we'll go here.
My name is Arnold Zeitlin, and I teach in Guangzhou. In view of the contradictions that we've already discussed, do these contradictions indicate some kind of disconnect among policymakers in China? In other words, who's running the show? Who's making these decisions?
What's a contradiction?
Well, he was talking about what Ambassador Solomon was talking about between kind of the foreign policy and domestic tensions and insecurity being confrontational or seeming confrontational outside while you're trying
to... You have a rising peaceful China on one hand, and then you have policies that have alienated the Philippines,
the neighbors,
Vietnam, Japan, Indonesia, and the American business community. So who calls the shots on making these decisions that create that situation?
Well, I think that we are just scholars. We don't know details about who is making policies. But one thing is clear. I think all of the policies should be made by the Chinese government. And you cannot see this policy made by any individual who is not at the in the policy-making circle, right? This is a very serious issue. And second, people concerned that the wording peaceful rise and different from this China's foreign policy, I'm still confusing about this concept of why they regard this this contradiction between the action and the rhetorical principle. Peace for me it means the opposite phenomenon of war. If there's no war, why you regard that all of these actions as not a peace? And the East Asia is the region have enjoyed peace since 1991. And the peace is more durable than the situation in the Europe. And after the end of the Cold War, Europe have experienced two wars, the war in the Cold War and then the war in the Georgia. There's no any war in East Asia. There's some minor conflicts and clashes between North Korea and South Korea, but that's not war. So even today, this region, from my understanding, is still very peaceful. There's no danger of war at this region. People say, hey, there may be some accidents. I do not rule out that possibility. It's possible. If military accidents can be regarded as war, it's still different. So from my understanding, as long as the China and the U.S. maintains the asymmetric nuclear deterrence between each other, so then China is at the weak side, America is the strong side, and we still can keep the general peace in this region.
So I just want to make sure, if China then had a more symmetric nuclear capability, then it wouldn't keep the peace, then there would be war?
Oh, no. Actually, the symmetric nuclear deterrence can maintain the peace between the U.S. and maintain the peace between U.S. and the Soviet Union. The asymmetric deterrence between China and the U.S. maintain the general peace in this region. And if this China and U.S. if China develops a nuclear capability, narrow the gap with the U.S. becomes asymmetric. That means this effect, the impact will be more solid. That means the peace in this region will get more guaranteed.
Can I just ask, are you a rising lonely power in Guangzhou as well? And if you are, we should come together. It would enhance our problem. I'll just say very quickly, I would argue it's the same set of leaders, obviously, making those decisions. I think you have, again, you know, a contradiction. There's a lot of contradictions in China, as we know. Right now, many describe the policy approach in China as Jingyou Zhengzuo, right? So moving the economy to the right, moving politically, however, to the left. And Xi Jinping early on talked quite a bit about his views on the collapse of the Soviet Union and what happened. And one of the great lessons learned in his view and others in China is that the people in the Soviet Union lost the fervor of the ideology. And Xi Jinping is not going to let that happen in China. And so on the political side, you see national rejuvenation, you see political reindoctrination, all sorts of efforts to bring, to strengthen the party and to bring pride back to the Chinese people after 150 years of humiliation. Now, this side of the policy, I think, is manifested in ways that create anxiety outside of China and leave people wondering again, what kind of power is China going to be? On the economic side, you see more liberally oriented market economy. You see policies towards integrating more with the international community and a recognition that for China to continue to develop its economy and to grow its economy, sustain its economic growth, it needs an international environment that's conducive to that. And so it will try to implement a set of policies internationally that support that may seem more friendly to the international community. But on the other side of the equation, I think it leaves people wondering what kind of power is China going to be.
Okay. One quick point about the contradiction. In many Chinese scholars, that's United States also, suffered United States policy, okay, also foreign policy also suffered a similar contradiction. For example, okay, in Kosovo, United States say human rights is more important. In Ukraine, and that sovereignty, state sovereignty is more important, okay? And in East Asia and in many Chinese scholars that, okay, Obama and its high-level officers say many good words to China, okay? But also do many things that China unhappy to see that. So I think that's the why not the key question that is why China and the United States view each other suffer from the contradiction. I think that's okay. According to Professor Yan's theory, that is a superficial friendship. That is, we raise up the goal for our bilateral relations. And from my understanding, we also suffer another constraint. That's the structure constraint. That China is a long rising power, and then we are facing the constraint exerted by United States and regional neighbors. I give you an example that, okay, when China adopted the reassurance policy towards neighbors, United States worry about, okay, China will finalize my East Asia allies. Okay, when China adopt a reassurance policy towards United States, and all the regional neighbors will worry about, okay, United States will betray us. I think that's the big problem. That's the big problem, that how we can manage this kind of structure pressures on both China and the United States.
I just want to point out that the concept of peaceful rise goes back much further than the pressure points you're talking about, worrying about today. China is different from Russia, for example, in that its success depends upon open and good relationships with neighboring and global countries. It's a trading country. It's got the biggest trading nation. It's got maybe as much as $100 billion a year that's going to be coming out of China in the future that needs to move. So it needs what I call good open collaborative relationships to continue to prosper. And that's the concept of peaceful rise. That concept of a peaceful rise, which has existed for a long time, did not mean that China had what I would call flexible position vis-a-vis, for example, Taiwan. That's a territorial issue. The islands are territory issues. And basically, the position is on territory issues, that's a political security concern. It's not similar or part of what I would call a peaceful rise concept. In global public opinion, however, they're intermeshed. And I would say that China, of course, cannot win the hearts of the minds of the global community as long as it has a very firm position on territory issues. It's just going to come across as being seen aggressive. They're in some ways in the public opinion fundamentally not compatible. But in the minds of, I would say, the China leadership, these are seen as two separate kinds of tracks.
Yes, this gentleman back here.
Oh, yeah. Steve Winters, Washington-based researcher. Maybe I address this to Yukon Huang, actually. But I was surprised recently to hear several policy experts here in D.C. and also government officials sort of touting the concept of financial warfare, and this is a way that the U.S. can achieve aims without getting into a shooting war. Yeah. A good example, going historically, they point to the sanctions against North Korean banks and so forth and so on. And now we have, of course, the Iran sanctions. So I don't go into the whole history of this thing. I would be interested to know, number one, whether this growing financial warfare that's going on is going to throw a factor into these projections for Chinese economic development that hasn't maybe considered from the World Bank perspective. And I'd be interested from the Chinese guests to know, it seems to me the Chinese response to this is sort of schizophrenic, because on the one hand, they're very strongly condemn the types of sanctions the U.S. is putting against, say, Russian banks or XYZ. But on the other hand, they seem to put a lot of pressure on U.S. companies. For instance, this thing about Bloomberg terminals and the fact that they said Bloomberg doesn't start, you know, possibly punishing them for future reporting by refusing to let them sell their cash cow in China, which is the terminals. So it seems to me it's sort of a schizophrenic policy. They are doing it themselves, but on the other hand, they don't like the idea. So where is this all going to lead?
Can I just make one plea, which is, because I think language is important and we go running off on metaphors, to not call it economic warfare, because partly it's coercion, but there's a big difference between warfare and sanctions. And if
that's
we conflate
what the people in D.C. are calling it, that's what I'm saying.
And I think the use of language in D.C. is often very problematic as well. I know. I'm just saying, I know where it's going, that train's going, and it becomes dangerous, yeah.
I would like to support this question. I like this question very much. And actually, in China, a very popular book titled Financial Warfare. Exactly. And in both China and the U.S., among the medias, and the conspiracy analysis is very popular. And people like it. They enjoy it, like entertainment. And so that's from my understanding. The media, in most cases, they worsen our relationship rather than help to improve our relationship. And this book is so popular in China, and because there's so many reports by the media about this guy is so smart, they said he discovered that, and because the book published before the 2008. And so they said, look at that, this guy can foretell the financial crisis, and which was caused by Americans' financial warfare. And actually, the people never ask the question. If America launched the financial warfare against the rest of the world, why did it not stop it when Americans were hurt by the warfare? This is very. But I argued in my way in 100 times. No one wants to listen to it. People enjoy the book. The book is still on the airport and people like it. They say, so, you know, I think that's human nature. Because we are human, we don't know the nature very much. So we concern this conspiracy and or something and composed by a power beyond a human being. What it is, beside God, the only thing is a conspiracy.
I'm tempted to make a quip about that, but I don't want to get in trouble. Did you anybody else on there?
No, I just make one observation. The more the major economies are interlinked, trade-wise, financial-wise, any kind of financial warfare or sanctions basically reverberates both ways. You both have much more to lose than you can gain. So I don't actually see this as a serious kind of weapon that could be utilized in any particular way.
Well, but I worked a lot on Iran.
Against each other. Against other countries is a different issue.
Right, and that's why I was objecting to warfare in a sense, because if you have international norms, you have international rules, you have international interests, and when somebody's violating them in clear ways, and I'm not talking about China in this case, and the question is what kind of responses there are from the international community that also take into account humanitarian interests, the interests of civilians, and so on. And warfare often doesn't do that very well, and so then you look for alternatives, and up pop. You know, sanctions is an issue, which I think is a broader issue in U.S.-China relations, is what are the international instruments for the Security Council and so on as one moves forward in time and as China's power grows, and this question of its global role, and what are the instruments then to reinforce agreements, global norms, and so on will be an interesting issue where we do have differences and somehow need to figure out how to work them out. But I think that's a topic for another discussion. Are we out of time or running out of time? We're running out of time. So I'm going to take just one question there. I'm sorry. His hand was up first. And then if you guys have any brief last comments you want to make, go ahead after this question.
David Sedney, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for East Asia and State Department official. Sorry, George, two questions. First, going back to the whole issue of the Russia-China thing, and Paul Hanley mentioned the issue of China's economic interest, is the emergence of shale oil and shale gas as a potential comparative advantage for the U.S., does that play a role in China's decision-making? Are the Chinese looking at that down the road as something they have to take out insurance against by this deal with the Russians to have their source of gas to sort of counteract that potential advantage by the United States? The second question is, going back to the whole Sunnylands thing, a few years back, the U.S. Surfaced the idea that Bob Selleck had the idea of that we were... essentially strategic partners. I forget the exact word that he used, but we tried to use a concept and pushed on the Chinese to describe our relationships. Similarly, this time the Chinese used the somebody else is going to remember what the words are.
Responsible stakeholder.
So we use that responsible stakeholder term, which the Chinese never accepted. This time the Chinese used this great theory of great power relations, which is Ambassador Solomon said, I think a lot of us still don't understand, which I don't think the administration really accepted in sunny lands. But is there a danger in this trying to condense the relationship into a short kind of phrase like this, a short kind of policy, as easy as it may be, that it papers over all the complexities that you all were putting out, and every time we do it, we actually make things worse? Just a question for anybody.
Great. Your question.
Sure.
Take that question as an opportunity to then weave in any closing thoughts you have
sure.
as well.
Sure. Thanks for the question, Dave. It's good to see you. I'll take the second part of that question and let others talk about shale. I think that yes, this new type of great power relations concept has left, many Americans wondering, again, as I said, is this just a Chinese attempt to, number one, get respect internationally? And certainly we respect, China's economic development. But the question is it also an attempt by China, some wonder, to get the United States to concede on China's core interests? And are those the only two things that are part of this? What is this really about? And as you allude to, the United States has been careful in how it responds to this. President Obama said it was interested in new models of cooperation, didn't use the specific phrase, which I was in China at the time and got many questions from Chinese. Why did President Obama object or discard President Xi Jinping's proposal for a new type of great power relationship? And I argued at the time, he didn't object to anything. He just, the United States doesn't really understand, what it means. And I think the administration at least appreciates what underlies the concept, which is an attempt to, there are historical cases. There's a study at Harvard since 1500, 15 cases of a rising power and an established power. Of those 15 cases, 9 have resulted in some sort of conflict. And so the idea is, how can we move to a new type of great power relation to try to avoid that? Susan Rice in November then made a statement that said the administration is interested in exploring how to operationalize the new type of great power relations. And I think the word operationalize is really key here from a U.S. standpoint, which is the U.S. is interested in enhancing cooperation with China, as I said at the beginning, and has been very enthusiastic and aggressive in trying to propose ideas to do so. But it is not just interested in a new definition of the relationship or a new bumper sticker for the relationship. And in fact, there are political problems with that in the United States to accept, as you have referred to, a new definition for the relationship without actually showing concretely how the relationship has changed to support that. So in conclusion of the remarks today, I would say I think it is very important, as I said at the beginning, that our leaders on both sides put as much energy into the differences and the areas of tension that we have, that we put as much energy into figuring out how we can cooperate and move on a positive agenda. I teach a course at Tsinghua to Chinese undergraduates, and I, for their final exam, gave them a question: what can the United States and China do together that would constitute a headline initiative? That is to say, an issue that would make the headlines in a positive way and not a negative way. And these Tsinghua students are very bright, and they had all sorts of great ideas. One of them said to eradicate a childhood disease. My former boss, Steve Hadley, talked about that on his trip to China in October. Another student said the United States and China should do a joint mission to Mars. But I think our two leaderships...
We'll use Chinese money for that.
these kids had great ideas in ways in which we can work together and begin to convince our publics that the relationship isn't only defined by these areas of tension or problem areas, but also defined by the United States and China working together for the greater good. And I think we've got to figure out a way to get there. Otherwise, potentially, I think we may be in trouble.
I just one brief suggestion. What I really worry about is you have two major trade negotiations. One excludes China, one excludes the U.S., covering the Asia region. It doesn't make any sense. And it creates a sense of confrontation or containment or, in fact, provides no platform for peaceful discussion. This is a very simple fix, actually. The simple fix is that both of these should have the other, the excluded party, as an observer. These issues have to be brought down together somewhere down the line. The earlier you get both parties to understand what the issues are, how they're being approached, the more likely you are to be able to get to a, what I call a uniform conclusion a few years from now.
Thanks. Dr. Sun, and then Dr.
Okay. I fully agree with you. That's more important that we manage our competition relations. That's more important than calling a new concept, okay, the stakeholder or strategic reassurance or the new type of power relations, okay. But I still want to argue that, okay, now the China-U.S. relations still face the similar problem, okay, power in Beijing, okay, and that how China manages relations with the United States and its allies, okay, in the regional level and the global level. I think that's the true challenge for both United States and China.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, very brief. I think the shale gas, American shale gas is a very positive actor, and the China will need a lot of energy for the next 10 years, and the American shale gas is a help to reduce the price of the energy globally. And someday, and when U.S. becomes an exporter of the safer gas, and China will be a good market for U.S., and also China will be happy to import cheap gas from the U.S. And the second thing about the short term, I think that's a big problem. Linguistic problems sometimes turned into political troubles. And because the short term always misleading, and people can give any kind of interpretation or definition for that term. And so this kind of diversities of different definitions about the short term cause some troubles. And the final thing, I think this is a really new thing. In my latest book, I suggest that China and South Korea should improve our military relationship, and China should make considering to develop a military alliance with South Korea. And last week, I had a meeting there talking about this issue. And then my American colleagues warned me that, hey, you should be careful and don't finalize our allies. That's dangerous. And in my book, I said that I strongly support the government to isolate Japan. They said, hey, this is dangerous. And the Japan is our allies. You cannot isolate it. We really don't know. You want us to have good relationship with your neighbor, your allies, or bad relationship with your allies?
Well, not too good. Not too good.
And not too bad.
thank you. I want to thank all of you for coming, and especially thank our panelists for a great discussion.